Başarı
Thank you very much, Shepherd. Sorry, I'm struggling with network even today. My questions are as follows. Give me a second, Shepherd. Thank you. Thank you to the NDOH and the minister for their presentation. I wanted to ask firstly to the minister what the position of the department is on the discontinuation of the low cost benefit option. Because we know that the CMS released two circulars in 2019 which will be in effect from next year March. That will see the low cost benefit option no longer being available. But we obviously have the knowledge that this is a medical alternative option that is available or that is used by people, primarily the working class, your petrol attendants, your domestic workers, and even unemployed people who don't afford medical aids. And second to that, who don't have the convenience of time of having to go to the public healthcare system, of having to wait the whole day at clinics that only open between 8 o'clock and 4 p.m., but need healthcare or need chronic medication. So I want to know why the department hasn't said anything in regards to this particular thing, because it's something that we should be taking as a big concern. So I want to know what the minister and the department's position is on this particular thing, especially because the CMS says this is in preparation for the NHI. The NHI will not be fully implemented even in 2026, and that they know already themselves. They know that it will not be a waking reality as soon as possible. And the last thing that we should be doing is to now influence or impact one of the poorest cohorts that have to access the public healthcare system that is already overburdened, by the way. And the minister will know this as well. And then secondly, I think we'll be going in and out and back and forth as we do every year. The department and the entities are regressing each and every year consistently and sustainably. And now I think we should start swaying away from what will you do as a department, what will you do as the minister, and you must start accounting more than that, because it can't be that the public healthcare sector is in shambles. And then each and every year, year in and year out, you're coming back to tell us you've improved, when we know that you have improved, that you have regressed, in fact, steadily, even as per the assertions of the Auditor General. So I want to know what then becomes the consequence management of the fact that you, minister, and your team are failures. You're failures. South Africa is now faced with a debilitated and collapsed healthcare system because you have failed as a government. You have failed. I want to know, what must we do as a portfolio committee with your failure as a minister, that from this entire time, and we can't even just mark your presence as a minister just from now, because you've been a deputy minister even before that. So generally, you're part of a cabal, you're leading a group that has failed the people of this country in delivering sustainable and also capacitated healthcare. It is not growing. You are stealing monies, you are corrupt. It is just, it's a show, really, of what's happening in the NDOH. Can I just speak and finish, please? Just because my words are cutting the wrong place.
I want to remind you, Honourable Chirwa, on your choice of words. The word...
It's not personal. I'm talking to the department. I'm talking to the department. The department is corrupt. Why are you fighting the word corruption? Why can't I say the word corruption in the portfolio committee meeting?
You said that the minister is stealing.
What rule is that?
Honourable Chirwa.
Yes, they must steal. Did this survive not happen? Did it not happen?
Don't go down this road. Just wait for
Don't provoke me, because I'm speaking to the minister.
I will have you removed if you keep on using...
That's all you do. That's all you know. That's all you know. Just to massage the laurels of those who feed me. That's all you know. You can't... I'm not here because of you.
Jefferson,
I'm not here because... You. I'm representing a constituency, and you will respect that. I'm speaking to the department. I'm allowed to say corruption. I'm allowed to say corruption. I'm allowed.
Secretary, please, I'm sure that Honorable Chirwa is removed from the platform. Thank you.
You deserve each other, you corrupt Mugogans in this committee with the ANC.
Secretary and ICT, thank you very much. Let's continue, honorable members. Number five, honorable Sukas. Let us be reminded, honorable members, to use language when we speak to each other and to be respectful to one another. Please.
Person, we are all under adults here. Yeah. We cannot be undermined like this as if we are children here, yeah, and allow a member to be a headless chicken.
Thank you, Honorable Sukacha. I am in control of my meeting. Thank you very much. Honorable Sukas.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by just thanking the department for the presentation and the report, and especially given the situation and crises within the department from with the senior management team being in crisis. Chairperson, I am going to speak to the presentation in broad strokes. And I think the worrying trend, not just with this department, it's across departments. I sit on three committees. It is the organizational capacity and ability to provide leadership on the high priorities as set out by the government. That is the concern. The department rightly states its role as providing leadership and enhanced governance in the health sector. Yet the department has been beset by issues severely affecting its credibility. And this points to organizational inefficiency and a culture of impunity that exists within the department that allows flagrant mismanagement and corruption. Now, the passion and I think for many people that or members that are working on the ground with their constituency, that are confronted with the questions by communities, the health crisis situations, it becomes emotive, and we are in the part of the year, and I'm not excusing anything, but I think we're in the part of the year where emotionally people are feeling it, especially if you are working within your constituency and you witness the failure, service delivery failures of the department in real time. And so my question to the department is, what plans are being put in place to affect organizational redesign and change in the department? Because you are providing leadership, because you have a high priority in terms of transforming the health sector, of which NHI is a total redesign of the health system, the credibility of the department in terms of governance is a major issue that must be addressed, and you will have to address it in your communication to the nation as well to the representatives that are sitting here. It is problematic when we are dealing with operational issues, and yet the organizational leadership issues are staring all of us in the face. Nou ons kan nou regtig wees soos dronk mense nie. We can't walk and do the tick box exercise in a committee meeting, look at the operational issues as reflected in your numbers, without us from a leadership perspective, speak to the issues of leadership credibility, because it does translate to how your messages are received from a health perspective. And our chairperson has very well said that the health of the nation is actually on the table. So when you, from a leadership position, fail in that aspect, actually it has dire consequences across all other sectors and across communities. So from an organizational redesign, if the minister is not able to give us an answer now, then certainly there should be, Chairperson, a presentation by the department to say, how do you deal with the gaping wounds that is evident within this organization, within this department, in order for us then to sufficiently address, of course, the high priorities. But it is problematic. It's a deep, deep concern that I must express here, that we're not dealing with the capacity issues. We're not dealing with the leadership issues. And those issues are actually critical if you want to speak of execution of strategies. So then my next question, which has been alluded to as well, the issue of procurement and strategic sourcing. Now, I have brought this up in relation to vaccination. I see this also across all departments, basic education, now with health. And we deal with things at a basic level, which is contract management. That is at a basic level. If you look at an organization chairperson, at a strategic level, you talk about strategic sourcing, which has to do with how we procure goods in order for it to be cost effective and profitable for the organization. Why is it so difficult that the biggest organization in the country, which is the government, doesn't demonstrate the kind of discipline that will ensure that taxpayers' money is being utilized at a basic level in a principled manner, and then at a very high level, at a cost-effective manner, to ensure that we are actually making sure that we're running a profitable operation that will be at to the advantage of our people. So I'm going to ask the question again. What is being done to ensure at a very basic level that contract management guidelines are being adhered to, and this translates to your performance indicators for people that are working within the supply chain processes? Then secondly, what are you going to do to give capacity from a strategic sourcing level to ensure you have the capacity that government actually function at a higher level when it comes to sourcing? Ons kan mos nou regtig met soveel geld werk op so 'n basiese vlakkie, chairperson. It's extremely worrying. And it is worrying to us as people, as representatives of the people, because we see the translation of failure on the ground, and it concerns us, because I know we all love this country. So let us do it in a better manner. So I hope they've got the two questions. Then I want to know, chairperson, I've spoken about procurement. Then there's a second element again. Again, it's about processes, and it is worrying. The vaccine rollout. The initial vaccine rollout I'm talking about has been compromised by factors such as a lack of research, failure of communication, and I won't even go into directives and all the things that are translated in terms of that. What research has been done to determine and track the South Africa's intention to be vaccinated? I know we had a presentation before that I asked the same question, and I'm not certain if it has been answered. Just indulge me and answer me on that. And then how many of our people intend to be vaccinated, and what research has been done to determine the causes of vaccine hesitancy? And again, of course, I don't need to frame it. I am framing it within the context of you're giving out this amount of money, you have on the softer issues, this amount of people that are hesitant, it has major implications. So if you, from a research perspective, can answer that. Then the link to that is the view of vaccination without parental consent. Now, Dr. Crisp went on national TV and stated that children as young as 12 can be vaccinated without parental consent. Again, we're talking about how you convey a message which has to do with your organizational capacity to ensure that people buy into your messaging. Informed consent is a foundational ethical concept in healthcare. And in my experience, very few children are able to give informed consent. Lack of informed consent is evidence of a corrupt healthcare system. So to attack the family in this way is wrong, and it's an intrusion. This is a comment of the state into the inner sanctum of the family. Would Dr. Chris please tell us how many children have been vaccinated? How many have been vaccinated without parental consent? Did he obtain a written formal legal opinion from the DOH legal department before making the statement he made on child vaccination? And did he obtain legal opinion from an independent senior counsel before making these statements? Again, in the presentation, there was a reference to the legal framework. So it is from that perspective that I'm asking the question. If he did not, why not? And if he did, can he forward these opinions to the committee? Then lastly, Chair, what plans are in place to use schools as COVID vaccination sites? Is the department planning a COVID mass vaccination campaign of learners in conjunction with the DBE? and how much money is being allocated to these programs if they are planned. And then I note that one of the aims is to improve community engagement and to reorientate systems towards primary health care through community-based health care programs to promote health. How does the department envisage doing this? And is it willing to make provision of state health care services in the community subject to the control of the community and to bring community level accountability that moves beyond community empowerment? I've said a mouthful, Chair. If you need me to repeat, I will, or if they want me to send it, I will through you, Chair, send you any other detailed questions if you would indulge me with that as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'm next. But before I ask my questions, I'm going to start by reading Honorable Naledi Chirwa's questions. Since she was kicked out of the system before she could complete her questions. And to humbly, before reading her questions, to say to the Chairperson, I think it's high time for us to have our own meeting and discuss on certain things that needs to happen in our department, as we asked even before, during the time of the deputy minister, to say we need the intervention of the speaker in our committee because of certain things that are happening that are not desirable. And at least also to have a suggestion of how we can solve other problems rather than kicking other honorable members out of the systems when they express their minds. The unreported questions from Honorable Chirwa reads as follows. Surgical mesh 2017 debacle alert was raised on J&J meshes that they were corruptible. However, there are patients that received these devices regardless, and Pindile Mube is one of them. One, reasons for this. Two, calling for an internal investigation on the general mesh complication crisis in the country. How many people received this information on how many cases of surgical mesh complications currently suffice in the country? Interventions by the department in conducting removal surgeries like in other countries. And lastly, a way forward in ensuring corrective surgery for the victims, asking that the department consistently report back to the committee on this request in written form. The other one, discontinuation of vaginal mesh. How will the department work towards this goal, or in the very least, conduct investigations into the outcries of mesh survivors who are organizing as mesh awareness activists in the country currently? The role of SAPRA in this process, noting their misleading of Parliament previously on never having received a grievance when they had in 2017 already. Following up on forced sterilization commission, deviations and exceptions. How does the department plan on resolving crisis of failing to comply with this legislation? My questions are as follows. The Auditor General reported that the financial statements of NDOH submitted for audit has not been prepared in accordance with the prescribed financial reporting framework and supported by the records that were needed. This is a framework or a matter of supporting sending the correct information. And furthermore, it is stated that material misstatements, you know, can you provide reasons why and how are you going to remedy that? Yes, I had those who were reporting, talking to us on audit improvement plans, but that is just a general word. It's not specific. It doesn't specify today to say which aspect are you going to improve, and how are you going to improve it? I mean, these are the problems of the National Department of Health. And secondly, it is said that some people who worked in the department and who had a private or business interest in the contracts awarded by the department failed to disclose such interest. We learned that disciplinary action was taken against some of the officials involved. My question is, who are the remaining officials outside the some officials that were disciplined? And when are they going to be identified and exposed? When is the anticipated time of the disciplinary hearing to take place against such individuals or such officials that are not mentioned to date? In connection with Program 6, Health System Governance and Human Resources, the AG was unable to audit the reliability of the achievement of 76 PHC facilities. How is your department going to make sure that the 76 PHC facilities do report on reliable information? The following question: can you brief us on the latest situation in the Northwest Provincial Department of Health? Next, what health promotion intervention in the department implementing? What is the promotion, health promotion intervention in the department that you are implementing with regard to antenatal care, especially in the rural areas? Can you report on the state of EMS in the country? During the election period, Minister, the records of COVID-19 were very, very low. Immediately after the elections have taken place, there is a mention and it's echoed throughout of the occurrence of the fourth wave. My question is, who is controlling this occurrence of this COVID-19 waves? Is this not business for other companies who are benefiting financially in this COVID waves? Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for this opportunity.
Honorable Masengwa, followed by Honorable Van Staden.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, let me greet the department in the report that is clear.
Honorable Sengwa, did we lose you? Honorable Sengwa? Honorable Van Staden, please continue so long.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've just got three quick questions. In the previous report we received, I think it was in September, we were already in recess of Parliament. Under Program 5 hospitals, there was an amount, I think, speaking under correction, I think it was 85 million wrongly paid over to provincial, one of the provincial departments by the National Health Department. I just want to know, my question, this is, has the transaction been reversed? Is the money back at the National Department of Health's coffers? My second question is, there was a report yesterday in the media about the National Department and the government who's selling the COVID vaccines to private companies. I just want to get clarity if it is indeed so, and if so, is it now allowed for private companies to procure COVID-19 vaccinations on their own and not through National Department of Health and on government? You remember at the beginning of this year, we had this debate about the procurement stories and outreach of vaccinations. So I just want to know, is a private company now allowed to procure on their own COVID-19 vaccines? I think the third question I had was, just want to apply my mind quickly. Yeah, on the latest stats of COVID-19, the numbers is relative low. I see we have a good rate of 96% of people who has not infected, so it looks getting healthy. I just want to know for government, and that's like my previous colleague has said, everybody is now speaking of a fourth wave. But we have industry elections, we have through the elections, we are going to Christmas. Is there any indication from the National Department of Health of on which date the fourth wave can be expected? Because according to the numbers that I'm seeing now, it doesn't look like that is going to happen any case soon. Thank you, Chairperson.
Very much, honourable members. I will now ask my questions to the minister. Minister, congratulations on your unqualified audit opinion, but the AG finds material misstatements continuously in the financial statements of the department. And although the department has had 10 years of unqualified audit opinions. Question is, what are the plans of the department to provide feedback on any planned action plans and whether there are such action plans in existence, and also progress on those action plans to address the poor audit outcomes on a quarterly basis? And then secondly, what is to be done by the department to provide to prevent irregular expenditure in the future? And in terms of that irregular expenditure, what is the role of the department to assist provincial departments of health to address increasing levels of irregular expenditure? And then in terms of your accruals, the question in my mind is, what is the department planning on dealing? How is it going to deal with these accruals? And how is the department assisting provinces to deal with the accruals? So in additional to all of the questions asked by the members, I know these are quite a number of questions raised, Minister, but you're very welcome to answer these with your team. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chairperson. And let me also thank all the members who have put questions. We will share the responses with the management team and the deputy minister. From Honorable Ismail, I'll just ask the acting DG just to allocate, I'm sure from environmental health, we should be able to respond on the issue of food quality, and the chief nurse, I hope, is on the platform, unless somebody else, on the nursing vacancies, and the acting DG, just to say something about the Pfizer booster. Let me just say on this one that at this stage, the only booster offering is in terms of the Sisonke 2 study undertaken again by the Medical Research Council using the J&J. And the reason for this is that at this stage, there is no general recommendation either from the World Health Organization or overall in terms of various regulators, including our own. As you would be aware that these vaccines were approved for, in terms of a particular application and usage. And at this stage, we are aware that there is a lot of experimentation and kind of trials in various parts of the world, and individual countries and regulators have made certain decisions, but from our side, the only additional doses which we have approved have been very specific in terms of people with particular immunodeficiency conditions, including those on cancer therapy, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, including those who are on renal dialysis, those on autoimmune treatment with steroids. So there are specific areas in which we have approved on the doctor's assessment and recommendation for those additional doses. But because of the fact that there's a whole lot of speculation, that's why, again, prioritizing the health workers, that's why we've agreed with the medical center to apply to SAHPRA, which has been approved for an additional study, which will entail a second dose or a booster dose of the J&J for those who, the health workers who were the first ones to receive a first vaccination through the Sisonge, the phase one Sisonge trials. So this will help us to get more information. And we have said that in terms of the others who have been agitating for Pfizer third dose as well, because Pfizer is a two dose. But what we have said again is that this, we must follow the same processes. We can't say on when other matters are, you know, have to be applied, we must follow the science and what is proven and what has been approved and assessed to be that it can be done through the regulators in the same way as the J&J booster dose study is happening. If there is a desire to look at a third dose of Pfizer as another study to see, because at this stage, the Pfizer vaccine is approved as a two dose, a full vaccination. So if there is any desire to go that route as well, let it follow the application, be assessed by the regulator, what would be the protocols if that kind of assessment. But we are not at the stage, either through world bodies recommendations or through our own regulator, we are not at the stage where there is sufficient information through proper authorized bodies to can actually start looking at the route of offering general booster doses for general members of society. My apology. So, but I'll ask the team, ATIN-DG and other members of the team, just to take up on that. And then also, I'm sure from corporate services, the issue of cost of legal action and disciplinary action, that also can be undertaken. Honorable Sokacha, I think the understanding acting DG will deal with the training of nurses and who are not retained. This is indeed true. The problem with this is that the reason why people who have been trained at the taxpayers' money expenses are not always all of them on completion employed by the same departments. It's basically that the desire is there and the need is there. But because of, as the CFO has indicated, a progressive decline in the budget allocation over the years and even the years going forward, until the revenue situation can be stabilized, our provinces are just finding themselves in very difficult situation, where if they don't limit further employment, the cost of employment as a budget line just crowds out all other budget lines such as maintenance of equipment, upgrading or maintenance of facilities, purchase of consumables such as medicines and surgicals and many other consumables, including food and so on. So colleagues have to balance the situation in which they find themselves, and that's why at the cost of the taxpayer, young people get sent for training, but at the end they cannot all be absorbed, not because they are not needed, but because of the budget shortcomings. Honorable Wilson, I think that method and I think Honorable Verstaden also raised that question. The acting CFO has dealt with, but he can come back on the unauthorized expenditure but you wanted to know, he has accounted for 30 million and the total is 49 million. And I'm sure he will be able to respond to that. Now, in terms of investigations, honorable members, I believe that we do have fairly robust check and balances. We have an internal audit function within the department, as is a requirement by law. We also are audited by the Auditor General. And quite a lot of time, we can't just go on a general investigation of procurement processes, supply chain management, unless if something, there's a red flag somewhere, either through the internal audit or through the Auditor General when they do spot checks, but not just the annual audit. In the advent of COVID, the Auditor General is looking at our expenditure very robustly, just in terms of COVID, but also now with the vaccine program, almost on a weekly basis, we do get audited. So I believe that we do have robust system of checking on irregularities. Here and there, some may be missed, but once there's a red flag, that's when we can be able to go into a deeper investigation, as it has happened in the matter which is well known on the Digital Vibes matter. The issue of the low cost benefit, I know that we have discussed this. The Council for Medical Schemes, its mandate is to protect the consumers in terms of health insurance products. So they continuously have to approve products and schemes and how they operate to make sure that this is in the interest and protection of consumers. And part of the dilemma which they have raised, we're still going to have further discussions with them, but I'm aware that part of what they have raised in terms of this low-cost product is the fact that in their own assessment, many of these products, they're actually more on the actual cost of administration of the major portion of what the members contribute to what they believe is going to cover them. The actual coverage is very limited. Just reading their report on this matter, they were indicating that some of this low cost, they promised, for instance, GP cover on the primary health, unknown to the consumers that they're only entitled to 3 visits to a GP in a year, just as an example. But also that a lot of these products spend more out of the members' contribution. A bigger portion goes into the cost of administration than into the actual cover benefits for the individual. So they have to grapple with this, and in the process of trying to protect the consumer, sometimes they may be seen to be harsh, but that's really the basis. But that's a matter which is, because we are also concerned that where there might be a proven benefit while the NHI is still coming, whether actually some of those can be protected. But we also can't stand in the way of the regulator, Council for Medical Schemes, if they do pick up actually that a product which looks very good on face value on the marketing, but in substance, in terms of benefits to the public, it's actually very little. So that's a matter which I'm sure at some stage, even the committee could be able to engage with the CMS, but they've got very logical arguments in terms of some of the products which they've had to take steps against. I'm trying to come back to Honorable Chirwa's issues. Well, Honorable Chirwa makes also very sweeping statements about the, and this is, I know that having been in this portfolio for some time, she's always making these sweeping statements that the department has failed, that all of us are corrupt, that the whole system. I'm sure. I don't know whether the honourable member, in fact, can really go out and tell the thousands of hardworking health workers, risking their lives in the middle of a pandemic, saving so many lives. I really don't know how she comes to, on the basis of what analysis and research does she come to this. Just to also say that a few months ago, one of the research companies which were assessing the confidence of the public in various public services did find actually that health was coming out much better than many other public services. In fact, I remember that the person who was questioning this researcher, it's one of the reputable research companies. Now, the TV presenter could not believe it when this person actually said that in the public, what they found out was that health services, notwithstanding the pressure under which they are, still enjoy a lot of confidence in the majority of members of the public. So I hope Honorable Chirwa could be able to be assisted to do a little bit in-depth analysis of, we don't dispute the fact that there is a lot of pressure, that our institutions, our professionals, professional nurses, doctors, and all other health professionals are working under a lot of pressure, but they're doing sterling work in saving lives and making sure that many more South Africans could survive from the pandemic and many other in the quadruple burden of disease. So we'd really encourage her to look at it also in a balanced way, look at the positive side. Honorable Sukas, indeed, we agree that we do need to strengthen our organizational design. As Acting DG will indicate, we are continuously looking at improvement, including in terms of our organizational structure. There's been a lot of relook at the structure. We are also in discussion with the DPSA in terms of improved organizational structure of the department. Also looking at, we accept the fact that with what has happened a few months ago, we did suffer a lot of credibility gap in the public, and that's something which we intend and almost best to make sure we can communicate truthfully to the public, and where we are not able to fulfill particular expectations, we should be able to honestly say so. So indeed, we are doing our best to make sure that we can improve in terms of our organizational capacity, redesign, and leadership, as you have said. Of course, on the issue of vaccines, we are aware that you have particular questions which you have raised about whether we have done research as to whether South Africans actually accept the vaccine. Indeed, I mean, when we didn't have the vaccines, the cry out there was, why is government not providing the vaccines? Now we're providing the vaccines. Of course, we accept the fact that as public service, you get criticized when you don't provide something, and then you still get criticized when you do provide what people have been calling for. So we it was never really our belief in terms of knowing that the information and the evidence was out there that vaccines do save lives. And even in our situation, even after rolling out to the extent that we have done, the evidence is there that the vaccines do save lives. So we don't believe that over and above information available throughout the world, that we needed to first before we could even, I mean, once the vaccines were proven to be effective and safe, that we needed to first do a survey as to whether people will accept them or not. We have rolled them out. We'll roll the vaccines out. We're still rolling out, coming forward to take the vaccinations. Of course, we admit that at the current moment, it's not the rate when we started and at the rate which we desire, the rate at which we are capable. But we're doing everything to encourage more people because we know that we have no doubt about the fact that the vaccines are effective and they are safe. In as far as the vaccination of children, Acting DG will be able to respond for the allegations you have made about what he has said. Our position is that we follow the law and that in terms of the Children's Act, in terms of medical treatment, children 12 years and above are taken as being cognitive enough to can make decisions in terms of medical care. And that is what the law allows. But we have also said that we would want to encourage that this be done under the support of parents and guardians. But what we are saying in law, if a 12, 13, 14-year-old comes forward and says, I'm ready to take the vaccine, I understand you, after counseling, they insist that they are ready, they understand everything. As a health provider, you have no legal right to refuse. But we have said very clearly that our preference would be for guardians, parents and guardians to also accompany them. The issue of surgical mesh, Honorable Tembekwayo, on behalf of Honorable Chira, Deputy Minister Zomo will deal with that. And there's a lot of matters Honorable Tembekwayo has raised, which have to do with financial statements, which the acting CFO will be able to deal with, including material misstatements. The issue of disciplinary action for officials who are found on the wrong side, in as far as the areas which have been investigated, that process is ongoing. As we promised the portfolio committee when we gave a report earlier on at the end of September, that process is already very well advanced, but any other who are found to be on the wrong side will be dealt with accordingly. I think other matters which arise from the AG's report, the acting CFO and the other team members will be able to deal with. Maybe acting DG and the team can deal with the issue of emergency medical services and also the issue of health promotion. Let me just, the issues from Honorable Van Staten. The issue of, I think the other matter is the same matter of which has been raised about the matter which was raised about unauthorized expenditure, a certain amount which Honorable Van Staten quoted a different amount, but I'm sure the team can deal with that. His question, again, I'll ask also acting DG just to add on this, whether a government is selling vaccines to private companies. At this stage, we do work with various private companies in terms of availing vaccines to them so that they can also be able to vaccinate those who are covered by medical schemes and also those who are not covered by medical schemes. And for those who are not covered by medical schemes, we do reimburse those private service providers for the cost of the actual service and also for the cost of the vaccine, where they've been there, because they pay to get the vaccine from the supplier, from the storage, from the warehouses, and we have to reimburse them for that. But let me just clarify on this matter that the government has never put a ban to say private companies can never purchase vaccines. We said that we would prefer that the purchase of vaccines be done through the state, but we never really put a ban. But it was the vaccine suppliers themselves who preferred to work with government in supplying the vaccines. And because of the fact that we're able to acquire this vaccine, sign the contract. It was actually, it became actually redundant for any private company to then go out and again source vaccines when actually they could, if they were to vaccinate at the companies, for instance, the mining companies, any employers overall, all the employers, we work with them at the works on the occupational side. There is a program on vaccination in on occupational sites, and this is through supply of the vaccines by the state. So it became redundant actually for companies to even venture into acquiring their own vaccines. The question of the fourth wave, also maybe dealing with Honorable Tembe Kwayo about the fourth wave. What is very clear, Honorable Members, is the fact that while the infection rates are low now, and we're all crossing our fingers that they remain so, we know that from the experience of the last almost just under 2 years, this has been a cyclical event where the infections go down and then, you know, driven by variants and also by movement of people, you know, the rate of infection suddenly spikes up again and creating these waves. And we can see also the pattern again, most of Europe is already under the fourth wave. There are lockdowns happening. Infection rates are very high, almost the entire Europe. So, and in the same way as it happened with the first wave, in a way, with the beta wave as well, a similar pattern, the Delta wave, which we just went out of, started mainly in India, then after some time also reached us. So the fact that once you see a high rate of infection across the oceans, the pattern is quite clear that it's a matter of time. So the more protection, the more safety measures we take, the better for all of us. Let me stop there, Honorable Chair. Maybe firstly, just maybe if we can get the acting DG, and then, or maybe before we do that, let me ask if the Deputy Minister wants to come in, and then we can, and then one or two areas where he may add, and then acting DG and the team can then do details of the rest. With your indulgence, can we give a chance to the Honorable Deputy Minister?
Yeah. No, thank you very much, Minister, and good day to the leadership of the Portfolio Committee Chairperson. The matter that the Minister is asking me to deal with is regarding the surgical mesh and the question of Honorable Chirwa. On the 23rd of August, I received a message from Honorable Chirwa, and then we started discussing this matter. In our discussion, then Honorable Chirwa gave me the number of Ms. Phindile Mncube. Phindile Mncube then got admitted subsequently at Steve Biko Academic Hospital. And I was very fortunate to be able to speak to the head of department, ONG, there to ask them to support her in whatever she actually was asking for. Subsequently, on the 21st of September, Honorable Chirwa accompanied Ms. Phindile Mncube again to Steve Biko, and the message I received from Honorable Chirwa was that, yes, we are being attended to by the specialist, and they will update you, Deputy Minister, if we need to get further support. But then in October, I saw a message in some social media written by Ms. Mncube, and then I contacted her, because I do have a direct number. I contacted her, and I said, look, can we assist further? I see that we have not really been satisfied. And then I then said, because you're a resident of KwaZulu-Natal, I'll make an arrangement that you go to Inkosi Albert Luthuli, to the office of the CEO. She's already waiting for you. Then she will take you to the head of department of ONG. And I will not go into details of what actually our discussion was like, but suffice to mention that Ms. Mncube declined that arrangement we're making. But just last week, on the 12th of November, I received a call from Honorable Chirwa again on this matter. And then and she did indicate to me, Honorable Chirwa, that no, Ms. Mncube has now changed her mind. She would like to be assisted can I rearrange? Then I did rearrange. She went to Inkosi Albert Buthuli, seen by the professor of head of department of gynecology and obstetrics, who then convened another team of other surgeons to assist her. She was then assisted and referred to Mahatma Gandhi Hospital, where I am aware she's being attended to. I spoke to the head of department just last week that she was given all the information that will actually assist her in the matter that she's raising. So I am specifically attending this matter because the Honorable Chira does call me, and then we do work on it very cordially. So we are keeping Ms. Mube on our radar screen in terms of assisting her. But just on another matter, Minister, which I know that our acting DG will attend to, that was raised by Honorable Sukes. This question of vaccination in children is coming very frequently. And you are right, Minister, we are guided and supported by the Children's Act. And I was just reminded that there are child-headed households, and there are certain children who are making very bold decisions because they have nobody else to refer to. I mean, like basic things like, what am I going to cook tomorrow? And children are making decisions like, should I go to school tomorrow or should I go to the other grant and collect the grant for the family so that you can leave? So children are already making very major decisions, and this is just but one of them. So the Act is actually supporting those children to say, in the absence of a grandmother and the mother, and you are a child-headed household, what decisions can be made? And this is among others covered in that. I just thought maybe I should add that to say, yes, in the Zomo family, the child should and might still consult if there's a family support. But what do we do with children who are child-headed and they have nobody else to consult? Thank you very much.
Acting DG, you can take the floor.
Thank you very much, Minister, and him, and for those. Just so that others can prepare, I'm going to ask others on the team to deal with some of the questions. So the questions that are related to nurse training and retention, Maggie Ravangani and supported by Dr. Kobe Murray can be prepare themselves to answer on those questions just now. And then Mr. Morawani will answer the questions related to primary health care about ideal clinics and where we may still have non-ideal clinics. There were also some other questions about food, which he may have the answers to more readily than us, and the emergency medical services in the country. Then all the finance-related questions about unspent grants, underspent grants, the Auditor General, the acting CFO, Mr. Nevitalo, will deal with that, but I may also come in and comment on some of the things that are reported by the Auditor General, where we may differ with both the Auditor General and the Treasury, and we've been discussing with the Accountant General about certain things as well. There were the questions that the Minister has dealt with, some of the questions, but I may add to those questions. But I think if that, and then Ms. Rennie will give the answers or explain how we go about getting legal services and how we pay for the legal services and disciplinaries, and what we've been busy with at the moment. But let me take the first shot and cover the majority of the other outstanding questions. So perhaps just to start off talking about where are we with the department, the national department. So the Honorable Minister has already said we are vulnerable, and we know we are, and we have been through a rough time. It's been very widely known in the media. Even prior to the COVID time, our department has been in dispute with our own staff about Civitas building. We've had a lot of labor unrest over the last 3 years, and we've then dealt with a flood, and you've heard the acting CFO reporting about how our personnel have had to go and work in other government departments to get access to systems. Some of the paperwork was damaged during the floods, and we have subsequently moved to a new building. So we know that we've been through a bad time, never mind the corruption, which I'll come to in a moment. But where we are at the moment, looking forward, is we have moved into our new premises. We are situated in the A.B. Tuma building, which is the old Exxaro building, which prior to that used to be the ESCOR headquarters next to Kwerchaka Hoogte and the One Military Hospital. We have settled in quite well. There are still a lot of issues around the finalization of the move, but with the rotation of staff and the finalization of our IT systems, staff are coming to work, and I'm personally very happy with the progress that we are making. There are a lot of vacancies in our staff, some of which were created prior to COVID, some have happened as a result of COVID, and some of which have just been attrition because people have retired. And right now we have a number of our senior managers on suspension, which, as I said, I will deal with separately. So I don't think any of this is a secret. It's well known and it's well publicized in the media. But perhaps just to give comfort of where we are. As we stand today, every single senior post has got somebody specifically delegated to be the, an acting person with the authority to act in those jobs. So the senior team, our executive, and the next level below the executive all have competent senior people who have been in the system and are managing their portfolios. The second thing is that we then identified the vacant jobs, and we have been advertising them. We prioritized those jobs, and I'm pleased to announce that three of our chief director posts, we have finished the interviews, gone through the screening of the applicants, and just yesterday, two of the three I signed, and one I signed a couple of weeks ago for the commencement of three new senior management and chief director positions. Regarding the deputy directors general, we have advertised the CFO post. We have advertised two of our chief the two technical DDG posts. We did not get sufficient senior applicants for the jobs, and we are embarking on headhunting processes as prescribed or provided for in the public service regulations. And that process for one of those posts has commenced. And for the other two, we have to wait a certain period before we can commence them. We will commence those as well. We do have some other posts that are advertised in our pharmaceutical space. There's another senior post that's been advertised. So we have a plan, and we are busy filling the key positions. But our organogram is going to change going forward. We have anticipated the administrative support required to build the capabilities for the National Health Insurance, and we have a number of positions identified that we still need to create for that. That will be done through a goods and services supply system, because we did not get money on our budget for conditions of employment to create any posts other than the one that I occupy in my normal day job. So we are going about it through a different route to get people on contract to start the processes and building the capabilities to run the NHI. For the other directorates, there's some reorganization necessary, partly because of compliance with conditions from the Department of Public Service and Administration, but partly because things have changed since this organogram was implemented more than 10 years ago. And we are consolidating and moving a number of our functions into different spaces and harmonizing it with our programs. That will take a little bit longer. We do need the concurrence of Treasury, and we need the concurrence because of the financial implications. We will abolish certain posts that are vacant in order to create other posts. And then the actual organizational structure needs to go through a process with concurrence of the Minister of Public Service and Administration. That has been going on for some time now, and we will in the new year hopefully get to a point where we can implement the new organization. So we very much have a plan. In terms of our relationship with the provincial administrations, we meet regularly through the National Health Council Technical Committee, and at the minister's level with the MECs, there's the National Health Council. There are regular meetings that are scheduled meetings that take place four times a year. But now during COVID, we meet fairly frequently on special meetings. We had one yesterday where we go through, today's was a regular one, not a special one. But we'd have items of mutual interest between ourselves. And there are subcommittees of those two big forums where technical work is done together with the provinces. So it's a very structured, you heard the acting CFO talking about the CFO's forum, and then we have another forum between our CFOs together with the provincial treasuries and the national treasury and what's referred to as the 10 by 10. These things are all functioning. We are generally happy with them, and we are confident that we are building back into a capable national department. So regarding the, I think it's important to mention that we do have a number of people on suspension still. So everyone knows our Director General is on suspension, and four of our other senior officials are suspended. There were others amongst them suspended in other government departments as well, not only our own, all as a result of digital virus. So we have reached a point where the investigating officer, which is a senior counsel appointed by the state attorney, has concluded the investigations based on the initial documentation from the SIU. They have collected their own information. They've interviewed a lot of people. And the charges have been formulated and were presented to the suspended officials, and the process, the appointment of the disciplinary chairperson, the date has been set, and the process has been communicated to the people who are involved. They obviously get that nobody's been found guilty yet, so they get opportunity to prepare their own cases based on the charges that have been made. And that process is running. The process for the disciplinary for the Director General is not managed in our departments, not by our minister or any of the officials. It's managed elsewhere in government because Directors General are appointed by the President. So I want to assure the members, and I'm sure the media and the public are listening to this as well, that we are not sweeping anything under the carpet, but we are following due process. And sometimes one just has to be patient. That due process, in order to be fair, needs to be given its space to run, and that is what we are doing. As far as the other questions that I thought I should answer, I think the ministers addressed the question of low-cost benefit options. This is a serious concern to us that sometimes products are packaged as if they are going to benefit people in the public space. But when you start to interrogate exactly what benefit is being provided, it is so limited that it does not hold value. And in some instances, it's actually just an industry. It's a money generation exercise that does not provide any significant benefit. So I'm afraid many, if not most, of the low-cost benefit options that are available at the moment fall in that category. And we have a parliamentary question we'll be answering in the next parliamentary session, where we will give a lot of details on exactly why we feel, how we feel about the cost benefit options. Because we are moving, hopefully going to move to a national health insurance framework as soon as the, and system, as soon as the bill is through parliament, all these will become moot points because the structure of the financing and the payment for healthcare will change as a result of that legislation. There was a question asked, several questions, also from Honourable Sukkos about the vaccine rollout. So, you know, without sounding defensive, the science of COVID and the vaccines is changing on a daily basis. And the more information that becomes available, the more studies that are done, the greater experience that is collected around the world, and because of the digital world we live in, we hear those information very quickly. There's a huge amount more information now than there was a year ago when decisions were being made about which vaccines to buy and whether to use this one or that one or the next one. So we're not going to even try and defend, but with the knowledge available at that time, a decision was taken. So the research that is being asked about, we've recently been required to prepare or been asked for documents for a court case. And just at first look, the total number of papers that have been considered by our ministerial advisory committees is in excess of 1,000 international journal papers. So to print and make all those available and put that in the public space is almost a futile exercise because there's very few people in the specific environment that is able to read and understand and collate that amount of very technical information. Do we conduct research? Yes, we do. Just about everything we do is backed up with our own research. But you start off by collecting what is known around the world from colleagues who are publishing in reputable journals, and then using that information to fill our gaps. So we are very happy to provide, and in fact, if the honorable members would like to go to our website, the SA Corona website, you can find and the departmental website, you can find the reports of all the ministerial advisory committees. And in those advisories that they submit to the minister, they list the key documents and the key research articles that they have used in coming to the conclusions and giving the advice to the minister. Obviously, there's a lot of other research outside of that, and we don't get time to look at everything, but we have an impressive array of scientists and clinicians in our country who are extremely diligent about sifting through and giving us information on what they believe we should know. We also have a lot of research being done on how the public reacts. So never mind the science, but how the public is reacting. And so the question was asked about vaccine hesitancy. We have a big team at UCT. We have the Human Sciences Research Council and various parties that who are associated with them, who are constantly giving us information. And we have a social listening group, it's called, coordinated and run through the GCIS, the Government Information Services, who are helping us to put together responses based on what's being heard. And one can imagine we have such a diverse society that we hear a lot of very different things from different parts of the countries and different parts of the communities within those parts of the country. So we are very happy to respond to any particular information, but most of this you will find on the website if you have time to spend. Otherwise, we can send the links to the secretariat and the honorable members can find the information there. I do want to talk about children because the Honorable Sukers asked specifically about what I've said on television. Now, I've been on television and radio, if once, then at least 20 or 30 times. I don't know how many, I've lost track. And many times I've been asked about children. So I want to say it for the record on this forum. Children are governed by the Children's Act as much as they are governed by any other piece of legislation, including the Constitution. We take our guidance from the legislation that is in the law books, in the statutes of the country, which this Honorable House participates in formulating. And that Children's Act has been in place since 2005 and has stood the children of this country well since 2005. And there's a provision in the Children's Act that children may consent to their own health care should they need to. Now, the Honorable Minister was very clear in his comments when he said, that is not our preferred way. We would prefer to see nuclear families, extended families, people looking after the children. We would prefer to see adults accompanying children for medical conditions and for treatment, for vaccinations and for everything. That's the preferred model for any healthcare practitioner. But that's not the reality on the ground. Many children do not have the privilege of even a guardian. And many children are beaten up and assaulted by adults that are supposed to be protecting them. So our Children's Act and this particular clause of our Children's Act provides an environment where children can be cared for and can be provided with health care on their own recognizance. And the Deputy Minister said there are some children who are forced to make very difficult decisions every day, even about how to look after their own parents. So the provision is in the law, and we did get a legal opinion, and we will provide the legal opinion as to whether children are allowed to vaccinate based on the provisions of the Act, the Children's Act. That is not our preferred route. Our preferred route is that children will be guided by a competent adult. And our healthcare workers are trained, they are aware, and they know that they need to make sure that for every patient, whether they're an adult or a child, they must get informed consent and tell the patient what it's all about. So up to now, up to last night, just over 328,000 adolescents between the age of 12 and their 18th birthday have been vaccinated with one dose of Pfizer vaccine. There was one more question I thought I should deal with. So the question of the fourth wave, the minister did allude to, I just wanted to perhaps start with a highlight to say it's very complicated. And there are a number of factors. If we knew exactly what those factors were, how they were going to turn out, we would be able to predict a fourth wave and a fifth wave in any way very accurately. But the fact of the matter is we can't. So we don't try and forecast. We do what's called scenario planning. We ask ourselves what if questions, and we have a very competent team of forecasters, our modelers who help us with this. And to try and just look at the headlines of what they look at, they will look at number one, do we continue as society to use the non-pharmaceutical intervention? If we do, we have a measure of protection of spreading the virus. Number two, do we have immunity in our communities? We can have got that partly because we had a lot of people who got infected, but hopefully the majority of it is because we vaccinated a lot of people. So if we keep vaccinating, and we are getting close to 25 million vaccinations given now, if we have a lot of immunity from vaccination and from wild virus infection, that is good. And if we keep vaccinating, it gets better. But the third and the most difficult to predict is that this virus mutates. And we don't know when and how it's going to mutate. So globally, there's a monitoring program where we watch which variants, and sometimes the variants are subtle changes and sometimes they're quite dramatic changes. We monitor all of the variants and the subvariants globally through a screening program and on a particular digital site. And again, we have very capable scientific teams that are doing this in South Africa, and we support and work with the neighboring countries because of the movement of the people between our countries. So we are at the moment not watching any new variants of concern. At the moment, it's the Delta variant. So if the Delta variant remains dominant and we do not get a new variant, it means that as a collective in the country, we are better protected because we have been exposed to this for a long time through the third wave. If we get a new variant, and that new variant is able to escape our immunity or bypass our immunity and requires new immunity, then we will get a larger wave. So we are watching very carefully. We're watching what's happening in Europe at the moment, as the Honorable Minister said. But we are also very closely watching Gauteng at the moment and a couple of other provinces, because the numbers have been going up over the last 4 days. And we don't know if it's just a flare-up or if it's something quite serious to be concerned about, and whether that could be the precursor to a fourth wave. But we have a lot of very competent laboratory and other scientists who are watching it. So I think we can assure the public we will know when we think there's a fourth wave on the way. So I think, Chair, if I can perhaps leave my answers to the questions and take them one at a time. If we could start, I think, just with Ms. Rennie responding to the question about what we spend on our legal fees and disciplinaries. And then from there, I'll ask Mr. Morawani to deal with the primary healthcare questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Crisp. Honorable, good afternoon, honorable members, the chairperson and the members of the committee, minister and the deputy minister. I will respond to the question of how we acquire services for legal services for our cases. As the acting DG has already said, we get our senior counsels appointed by the state attorney's office. So at this stage, we do not have the costing. They normally charge us after the fact, once the services have been confirmed as rendered for every case, any legal case that we deal with. So that also includes our disciplinary cases. Other than that, under normal circumstances, we use government officials for disciplinary cases from other departments or internally for any case that we are dealing with, and they claim normal claims, either kilometers or accommodation, for the cases that they are managing on our behalf. One, there was only one case where we had to go a procurement route, which is the case of the case that was indicated publicly by the DG regarding the internal investigation on the digital vibes investigation. And we spent in the tune of 497,000 for that particular investigation. That is all the response I have. Thank you, honorable members.
Thank you, Ms. Rini. Okay, Ms. Mariwani, will you take the questions I asked you to deal with, please?
Thank you very much, Acting DG, and thank you very much, honorable mayor, honorable chair, and honorable members, minister, deputy ministers, and colleagues. There are two questions that are for primary health care. The one of the patient that died after consuming rotten food in a hospital, I must say this is very regrettable and very sad. The department has a process in place of assessing service levels generally, looking at different domains, and food services is one of those. We do work with the Office of Health Standard Compliance, and we also have our own internal mechanisms through the Ideal Hospital Framework processes to ensure that we are do assess. But as it would happen with any other assessment, I mean, things may change quite slightly quickly because the issues of cold chain and safekeeping of food may just change quite rapidly. So we have then augmented that process with what we call a nutrition service level assessment tool. We actually have it in our annual performance plan. We targeting to assess 98 health facilities that are providing food for inpatients. And if we take that as a percentage of total hospitals, it's around 35% of hospitals per year. We hope that in about 2-3 years, we'd have assessed all hospitals. And of course, they are not at the same level in terms of quality of services. So there are those that are more advanced than others. So we hope that with that, we'll be able to cover that aspect quite adequately. But I do regret, I mean, the passing away of a person after consuming rotten food, as it was reported by the honorable members. Regarding the Ideal Clinic, regarding the number of clinics that have failed to maintain or get the ideal status, and which provinces are having higher numbers, the higher numbers are in the Eastern Cape, and it's not surprising from where we're sitting because they have the highest number of clinics. There are 766 clinics, the highest in the country. But also because it's vastly rural, and rural provinces are known for having a relatively poorer rural poorer infrastructure. So that's that, and that is followed by Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and the Northern Cape. Now we have entered a new cycle. Obviously, we have enrolled a larger number of clinics in those provinces to make sure that we take them through and reassess them again, and hopefully the picture will improve. I must say that the Ideal Clinic is progressing quite well because we have aligned the Ideal Clinic assessment tools with the tools of the Office of Health Standard Compliance so that we ensure that clinics are not overburdened with a lot of tools and being assessed several times. So OHSC has accepted that once we've done our baseline assessment, they don't need to do that. All they do, they just do external assessment. So in that regard, we are assured that our clinics get to receive a attention at a very high level in terms of a quality check. So thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me stop here. Thanks very much, and over.
Thank you very much. If I can go to Ms. Ravangani, and if she needs to be backed up by Dr. Maria, then between them. But Maggie, if you'll take it next, please.
Thank you, Dr. Crisp, Acting DG, Honorable Minister, Honorable Deputy Minister, and Honorable Members and Senior Managers in the Department. For me, I'm here to respond to two questions which were raised regarding the training of the nurses at the nursing colleges. The first question is about the issue of retention of the nurses or the absorption of the nurses after training. And also the second question is about the vacancy rate. So the responding to the first question, the issue of the retention or absorption, it's not followed, but the process that we follow in the department, it's the normal recruitment process wherein posts are advertised and all the candidates apply, and then the best candidates get to be seated. So this is actually the process that we follow. And then on the second question regarding the vacancy rate, maybe what I could do is just to indicate that starting with the nursing assistants, in total, we do have 39,650 posts. Out of those, 35,946 are filled and vacant posts are 3,704. When it comes to the category of staff nurses, the total posts that we have in the system is 36,961. Filled posts is 31,766. The vacant posts in this category of staff nurses is 5,195. Then the third category is that of professional nurses or registered nurses. This category, we've got total posts of 73,509. Out of these, 64,016 posts are filled and the vacant posts are 9,493. Then we do have the fourth category. These are all the managers, which includes operational managers, some which are actually as in an assistant director level. These actually in total is 21,694. The filled post under this category of managers is 17,723. Then the total vacant post in this category is 3,971. So therefore, in total, the vacant post that we have is actually 22,363. So these are the number of the number of the posts that we have which are vacant in our system. Thank you. Over.
Thank you very much for that. I'm not sure if Dr. Maria wanted to add anything from her angle about the nursing colleges. Okay, otherwise we'll go to the acting CFO. So I think we'll leave, there are many questions about money. I'm just going to leave Mr. Nebutalo to start with that, and maybe I'll end off with the last comment. Thank you.
Thank you, acting DG. And there were a number of questions that were directed to the acting CFO. I need to start by saying that I don't use it as an excuse. I was appointed in August, so this audit process was a very challenging exercise because I came at the tail end. So my first interaction with the AG office was on the 10th of August, where they were expected to finish on the 30th or 31st of August. There was an issue of material misstatements. 2 days before we received the final audit outcomes, there were four material misstatements which could have led to us receiving a qualification. And I then said, it can't happen under my watch that the department has received unqualified for 9 years. Then on the 10th year, we will receive a qualification. So those issues were immovable, tangible assets, meaning work in progress in infrastructure, we managed to deal with that because the following day, everybody was called to Centurion with myself to deal with these issues until late hours. The one issue that was a big problem was the issue of payables and receivables. In simple language, we are talking about the confirmed balances that we have as NDOH together with provinces. One of our biggest problems was the Cuban program, which we had to deal with it. So as part of the way forward to say, what are we doing to avoid that? I then realized that as CFOs, there is, we are far, there's a distance between the CFO and the Cuban program. So what I've done is that I've brought the Cuban program financial management team very close to the CFO's office. And as we speak, they are visiting each and every province where they are auditing each and every file of the students who are in Cuba. And we then issue a formal audit report, which I sign off for the CFO of that particular province and the HODs to deal with the matters, and they have to report to me on the 17th of December. And we are not going to stop at that. We are going to go back to the provinces towards the end of the financial year, where we have to discuss about all these balances, because what the AG does is that as they are auditing us as NDOH national, they then have to confirm with their provincial AGs to say, what are the balances that the province are having? So we had that difference. So that matter is under control. The one issue that also led us to this, to the unauthorized expenditure was an issue where there was a system issue regarding the conditional grants where there was a double payment. I then also for that, as we speak, we are busy conducting the half yearly reviews on conditional grants with all our provinces. The team was in Northern Cape for this week. Next week, even myself, we're in Free State dealing with Cuban program and dealing with the half yearly reviews for conditional grants so that these balances should not give us a problem. So fortunate enough, the material statements were corrected. Hence, we received the unqualified audit opinion. And we are saying, come the next audits, we'll make sure that these don't happen again. There were issues, the unauthorized expenditure. Like I've said that we incurred this on two programs. It was on program four, Port Health, where we had to pay overtime for officials for Port Health. Meaning that we had an overspending on compensation of employees. But when you look at the overall spending on compensation of employees of the department, we did not overspend. Meaning that there is some accounting measure that could have been done to that could be done to correct that. Unfortunately, this matter was discovered by National Treasury when we're writing the annual report, and it was very late, we're not allowed to correct. The second point is, I said, we had it on program six, where we had an overpayment that went to KZN. And the KZN treasury, because we have to be refunded by the treasury, because we transfer money to the treasury, treasury transfer money to the department. They refunded us in May. So that in it, we have got the money. So for us, we are busy writing to National Treasury to request them to allow us to correct the accounting records and financial statements in dealing with this issue of unauthorized expenditure. Because we have got the money, and if you look at compensation of employees itself, overall we did not overspend. So it's a matter of accounting records and understanding amongst ourselves, National Treasury and AG. There was a question on accruals. Yes, we have got a huge challenge with accruals in the health sector. As we speak, they are over 15 billion rand. But they are a result of medical legal claims. Why? Because some provincial treasuries, for example, Eastern Cape, they don't allow our provincial departments of health to budget for medical legal claims. So meaning that when we get a claim, when a provincial department gets a claim, they have to settle without having a budget for that. And that leads to accruals because some things are not going to be paid for that particular year. But to deal with that problem, we have requested all our provinces to come up with their cost containment measures. They've got, and even consolidated at a national point, cost containment measures in trying to deal with the challenge of accruals. And the second thing, we are always engaging, we're always encouraging our provincial departments, together with ourselves, to engage with treasuries to be assisted where possible with additional funding in dealing with these accruals. Hence, when provinces are called by their provincial treasury to bid for budgets and discuss budget issues and so forth, with my permanent appointment in the department, I attend those meetings as the chief director for provincial support. The issue on procurement and supply chain management, it was raised by the AG, we have got a challenge. Because we have got a challenge here, and even the acting DG has spoken that there's a new organogram that we are pursuing, because within supply chain, we don't have a dedicated unit that deals with contract management. But in terms of the new organogram, we have got that. So we are hoping that the structure will be approved as such, and we are able to focus much on contract management because it's one area where we are finding ourselves in trouble. The last thing I need to deal with, there was a question on the underspending on conditional grants for provinces, where I reflected that we provinces were allocated 52.6 billion and they spent 51.2 billion, resulting in underspending of 1.3 billion. So the question was, I must read the breakdown per province of underspending. Eastern Cape underspent by 1.7 million, Free State by 239 million, Gauteng 524 million, KZN 99 or 100 million, if I round it up, Limpopo 229, Mpumalanga 37 is it 1,000. Northern Cape 7 million. Northwest 263 million. And Western Cape 0. But I then indicate that as provinces or in terms of DORA, provinces are allowed to request for rollovers of this unspent money if they are able to demonstrate that these monies were committed, with the exception of grants that deals with compensation of employees. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Acting DG, I'm just checking here that Mr. Murawane, there was a question about emergency medical services, whether it's functional, and then I don't know whether it, I think you had allocated to Mr. Murawane, and then health promotion, whether we're still able to undertake health promotion, including antenatal care. Those are just two which I've seen. Maybe quickly, if either himself or anybody else can just deal with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Murawane. And then I'll give the answers to some questions about the Cuban numbers.
Thank you very much. Let me respond to the health promotion. We have identified a number of services that got impacted upon as we're responding to COVID-19 pandemic. We then have a program called the Continuity of Essential Services program. So through that program, we do receive updates from Health Information System. And it is clear that while the numbers were slightly affected, but the services continue to be delivered in all services, particularly antenatal clinics as one of the examples. But we do draw out a number of data elements and report on them. And as a matter of fact, we're doing that. We're meeting every Tuesday at 1 o'clock to assess and review that. So we've also set provinces to make sure that that continuity of care and health system recovery is taken forward through proper planning. And we are coordinating that planning. So just to make sure that no service is left uncovered because of COVID-19 pandemic. And I do report, I can confirm that the data has shown marginal decline, but not really decline of anything less than 60% decline. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you much, very much. If I can just quickly give the numbers for the Cubans, because there was a question from Honorable Ismail in the chat. So in terms of the integration of students into the system, into the healthcare system now for doctors, over the past 4 years, so that's the numbers of doctors. The breakdown is a little bit more complicated because it goes back to 1997, but I can give these figures. In the Eastern Cape, the absorption has been 247. In the Free State, 176. Gauteng, 401. KwaZulu-Natal, 663. Limpopo, 313. Mpumalanga, 175. Northern Cape, 358. And Northwest, 105. So the total number has been 3,434 in this period, the numbers of students integrated into the services. There are other more detailed questions, I mean, figures around the students over the years since 1997, but I think that would be laborious, and we can rather give the chair a presentation for distribution. Thank you. So Minister, Honourable Chair, I'm done from our side. Thank you.
Well, I was hoping for somebody to comment on the emergency medical services. You don't have Ravin or somebody from that section? Dr. Christ?
Yeah, Minister, I'm looking to see who's on the, who would know the specific answer to the question. But from my side, I mean, we all of us, Minister, are following what's happening. We have lots of challenges with our emergency medical services. It's a complicated program where we have provincial services, and then there are services that are in the metros, in local government, and then they have contracts with private ambulance providers as